Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth McCarthy. I'm a producer and presenter on 3RRFM in Melbourne, and I'm a literary critic and book reviewer on Triple R and ABC Radio Melbourne. I'd like to start today by acknowledging that I am on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to elders past and present, and I extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening in. It's such a pleasure today to do this podcast for Melbourne Writers Festival. I'm interviewing two authors, and I'm going to tell you about them right now. First of all, Jenny Valentish is a writer and journalist. She's a regular contributor to The Guardian and the ABC, and she's the former editor of Time Out Melbourne and Triple J's J-Mag. She's written two blogs, New Age Guinea Pig, in which she donated mind, body and spirit to pseudoscience, and Hey Man, Now You're Really Living, in which she set herself the mission of doing something new every day for a year, from pro wrestling to jumping out a plane to blowing shit up. And Jenny has written three books. She's written the novel Cherry Bomb. She's written the Walkley-nominated research memoir hybrid Woman of Substances, which investigates the female experience of drugs and alcohol. And now her latest book, which is called Everything Harder Than Everyone Else, Why Some of Us Push Our Bodies to Extremes. And as the title suggests, Jenny explores the worlds of endurance athletes, porn stars, wrestlers, fighters, extreme performance artists, to find out how and why some people find extreme pleasure in what many of us would regard as extreme pain. Hey, Jenny, welcome today.
Thanks, Elizabeth. That's a lovely intro. I'm here in Castlemaine, actually, so I'd like to pay my respects to the Jar Jar Wurrung people.
Excellent. Sarah Krasnostein has a PhD in criminal law and is a writer and journalist. Her first book of non-fiction, 2017's The Trauma Cleaner, won the Victorian Prize for Literature, the Australian Book Industry Award for General Non-Fiction, the Victorian Premier's Prize for Non-Fiction, the Dobie Literary Award, and jointly won the Douglas Stewart's Prize for Non-Fiction at New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards. She's been nominated for a Walkley Book Award and was shortlisted for the National Biography Award, the Melbourne Prize for Literature, and the Wellcome Book Prize in the UK. Sarah's latest book is called The Believer, and it is about ghosts and gods and flying saucers and certainty in the absence of knowledge. Sarah seeks out and speaks to the seekers, the believers, the torn and the frayed, and presents a deeply compelling series of portraits of believers. Hey, Sarah, how are you going?
I'm well. How are you?
Yeah, good, good. So it's such a pleasure to speak to you both today about these books. These are two of my favourite books of the year. And we're here to talk about a few things. I mean, chiefly I'd like to explore how far a creative non-fiction author immerses themselves in a subject when writing a book. So as a starting point, could you each talk about the starting points for writing these new books? Jenny, you were about to write another book when you took a detour into writing this one. Could you talk about how the idea for this new book came about, what the spark was, what made you dive into the world of wrestlers, fighters, porn stars, ultramarathon runners, you name it?
I mean, why would you not want to when you put it like that? But I was going to write a book that, funnily enough, was like a total 180. So it was with this psychologist I greatly admire, Dr. Matthew Berry, and we'd been talking about his theory that, you know, we live in an age of great distraction, and there's a kind of breed of people he calls the distractors, and they're people who, their method of dealing with emotional pain is to distract themselves. And it's so easy now because we've got real high sugar foods, we've got loads of junk food, we've got our smartphones, we've got porn. So all these things just allow us to completely escape and not sit in our emotional pain. So we were going to write that together. And then I started thinking, yeah, but I am one of those people. And I kind of think it's a valid coping mechanism, and you know, it can be quite productive. And I started thinking about what I call the natural born leg jigglers. I'm actually jiggling my leg right now, but people who are, you know, sort of quite antsy naturally And then some people just find a really awesome way of distracting themselves from that antsiness. And so I wanted to really kind of celebrate and not pathologize people who have these real kind of high octane professions and pursuits, like, as you say, wrestlers, fighters, porn stars, ultra marathon runners, and really look into why they have chosen these things and how they push through that discomfort. Because the title of the book, Everything Harder Than Everyone Else, does kind of have a double meaning. Like, yes, they do have this desire to go harder than their peers, but also they have a tendency to make things harder for themselves. But anyway, I thought these are my people, so that's why I thought I would dive headfirst into this subject.
Fantastic. And, I mean, they just tell such rip-roaring stories as well, don't they? Which is fantastic journalist fodder. And, Sarah, could you please talk about the genesis of your stories and, you know, in the new book, The Believer?
Yeah, sure. It's interesting because it's a nice segue because it's a kind of counterpoint to Jenny's approach, because these were initially, at least, not my people. And that's what sucked me into their stories. So it started with seeing this choir of Mennonite missionaries, and they look like Amish folks. They've got plain dress, you know, homemade floor length dresses for the women, and on the men, the beards that have no mustache. And they were very earnestly singing their hearts out in the New York City subway one day in the Bronx where I was changing trains, and no one was looking at them at all. And it wasn't kind of with an ironic eye or, you know, an appreciation of any sort of, like, it wasn't a mocking thing. I was genuinely struck by this kind of disconnect between these people that were doing something very heartfelt. And at the same time, you know, just another day in the city, no one was looking twice. And I really wanted to know who they were, why they were doing what they were doing. So I spent the next few months trying to answer that question in their living rooms and hanging out with them. And I didn't at that stage kind of think of what I was doing as an investigation of belief per se, but their story led on to the next story in the book and so on until I kind of had different perspectives on, you know, this question of why we're here and how we metabolize the fact that it all ends. So, yeah.
Wow. So could you each talk about the extent to which you each immerse yourselves in the lives of your subjects? I mean, what kind of boundaries do you have with these people? Because, Jenny, you did say, you know, the people in your book, these are your people. And at various times in your book, I, you know, got a real sense that you were hanging out with these people and you were kind of immersing yourselves in their world. So how do you know how far to sort of go into the lives of these people that you both write about, and how do you draw boundaries, and how do you get out as well?
I wouldn't say I did draw any boundaries. See, what I do is a bit different, well, very different to Sarah, really, in that I'm really into meeting really interesting people and saying, hey, this is really interesting. Look at these interesting things they're doing. I'm going to have a go. So it's boundaries aren't quite as necessary, really. And I'm a real fan of journalists who kind of treat themselves as human science experiments or human guinea pigs, you know. And George Plimpton was a key one for this book, because George Plimpton is the founder of the Paris Review. But in the 60s and 70s, you know, he wrote a series of books where he basically used his journo credentials as a hall pass and joined all these different kind of sporting leagues. You know, he was like a hockey goalkeeper with a major team. He fought a prize fighter in the boxing ring. And so when I was writing Everything Harder Than Everyone Else, I did sort of see it as method acting in a way. And I did things that my interviewees were doing, like I got choked unconscious by a jiu-jitsu fighter. I got flogged by a BDSM dom. I took steroids and I had a live streamed kickboxing fight. And really, you know, as far as I was concerned, it was just a case of, God, why wouldn't I want to do these things if I've got the opportunity? And it is a real privilege as a journalist. Like, you can actually dab a toe in a reasonably safe, short manner if you choose.
Yeah, and how about you, Sarah? What about your boundaries with people? Because you're also dealing with people who are going through, like, significant life changes and certainly in The Believer, there's someone who's dying. So how do you know sort of what boundaries to have when you're conducting your journalism?
Okay, so I'm having far less fun than Jenny. I am ideally schlepping along with my subjects when they're in their natural environment. And hopefully, instead of, you know, a very formal Q&A where we're sitting down in a dry or artificial environment, I get to watch them in their normal lives. I'm really ultimately interested in seeing the world through their eyes. So the closer I can get to that daily experience for them, even if it's very, you know, out of the ordinary for, quote unquote, the rest of us, that's fantastic for me. But I'm not participating in the sense that I'm going to be doing what they're doing. I'm more coming along with them to observe them in their world. So for The Believer, one of the stories was the Australian Ghostbusters. And so I went along with many of them when they were clearing haunted houses or, you know, having paranormal conferences. And I'm there. And it might look from a remove like I'm going along with, you know, the rest of the people there. But, my, you know, I'm taking notes the whole time and I'm asking a bunch of very stupid outsider questions. So in that sense, it's less immersive than it could be.
Well, Sarah, how do you know how much to insert yourself in the story? Because you are on the page in the Trauma Cleaner and in this new book, like you are present in the stories. We get a sense of Sarah. But how do you know how much you want, well, do you want to be in the story, or is it a case of your editor and publisher encouraging Sarah to be in there? Could you speak to that?
No, it was fairly that kind of aspect of my voice, which is often a first person perspective, is fairly intuitive when I only really have one voice. Other things are very problematic for me, but that is a fairly natural position for me. And I think that's because, you know, long before I wrote, you know, factually for a living, creative nonfiction for a living, I was a fiend for creative nonfiction books. And the ones that I enjoy most and always have enjoyed most is the ones where you're getting that insight into who's writing it. So I think it makes for, you know, as a matter of first principles, just a more interesting way of telling the story if we can see, you know, who it is that's telling us, what their particular position in the room is, you know, the filter through which all the information is going. I think that adds an interesting element to the story. But then ethically, I think it's a more honest way of writing narrative nonfiction, because no matter how careful we try to be and how diligent we are, the process is inherently selective and subjective and partial. So we're taking this undifferentiated pile of material that we can get about a person's life or a situation, and then we're whittling it down further to fit the bounds of the story or the length of the article or the book or whatever it is. So if I can put myself in there and make that aspect of the process more clear on the page, then I feel like it's both more interesting and also more honest way of doing what I do.
And Jenny, you are very much part of the two books that you've written. Could you speak to how, to the levels of comfort that you've felt across the two books? Because I imagine the first book, I might be projecting, but the first book I imagine would have been more uncomfortable than this new book.
Yeah, so with Women of Substances, I was the case study, my past story at least, was the case study for me to then look at the bigger picture of women and addiction and treatment. So the drawback of that was, even though I was quite careful to keep the majority of the anecdotes and the stories to my life in the 90s and early 2000s, I kind of feel that people didn't pick up on that. And so, you know, I would get that old, "Oh, that's brave," quite a lot when it came out or when people heard about what I was doing. And I think there's this assumption that people feel like you've told them literally everything about your life and why on earth would you want to do that? And it was uncomfortable because prior to that, I'd never, ever written about myself. And, you know, we were living in an era, this was 2017 it came out, so we were certainly living in the midst of the first person industrial complex of women in particular. Just lots of journalism was memoir based. A lot of it was opening a vein. And that was kind of expected. And I never did that. And I never even wrote opinion columns because I just didn't want people to know me. I was really private. But when there's something that is really important to you, you can't help but keep returning to it again and again, even if you're saying to yourself, no, this is a bad idea, let's not publish this. I realized after 10 years, this isn't going to go away, and perhaps it's the right hill to die on. So I decided to, you know, just go for broke and use myself as an example. And I also would feel much more comfortable using myself than somebody else. Like, I'm not Janet Malcolm, you know, and I don't have the kind of ruthlessness perhaps to put somebody else in the firing line of public opinion. And I wish I did, in a way, because, you know, it can be done really sensitively, but like the terror of having that responsibility would overwhelm me. But I do think in general, publishers are very into the nonfiction author being visible, if it's a woman in particular. Mm. It just has the drawback of, so even with everything harder than everyone else, my own story I wrote about having a fight and learning to fight was actually only in one chapter. But when it came to the press cycle, I was asked about that again and again and again and again and again. And other people's stories in the book, which took up most of it, barely got a look in because the journalist always wants you, your personal story, and again, you to open a vein on the radio show or whatever it is. Mm. So it ends up, you feel like you're promoting something falsely. So people are getting a false sense of what it is that you've created.
Wow. So has that been the most challenging part of the writing of across the two books, Jenny, is sort of revealing yourself for the first time in that first book, the first nonfiction book?
Yeah, but I suppose it really did have the effect of literally closing a book on an era of life, so that's really valuable. It does mean I never want to go into the zone of trauma and mental health and that kind of thing again, which is quite funny because my editor at The Guardian, whenever a book which is trauma related or a TV program is trauma related, immediately comes to me. But I feel like I've completely exorcised that now, you know?
Wow. Sarah, what have been the most challenging aspects of you writing the two books that you've written, The Trauma Cleaner and the new one? Like what are the most uncomfortable parts of writing the types of books that you've written?
I mean, I think there's many uncomfortable aspects when you write factually, because you kind of have to go out into the world and find and then create a story using the lived facts of others' lives or circumstances. So, you know, there's that ethical minefield permeates the task. But I mean, for me, both times now, I think that the hardest part is the gap between what I would like to get and what I am going to get. So, you know, in the absence of moving in permanently into these people's homes, you know, I have to see how close I can get. And I mean, with the way I work, again, like, it's funny, like Jenny mentioning Malcolm's ruthlessness, before you even have that ruthlessness about, you know, facts and construction and how you portray somebody on the page is, you know, going in and pursuing the subject and maybe convincing them to speak to you. My work self-selects people who want to participate because I'm only going to ask once, and if it's a no, I have to find something else. So even before I get to the problems inherent in the writing and then the ethical issues of portrayal and truthfulness and balance and all the rest, you've got to find somebody that, you know, has legs. And by legs, I mean something more than surface level, something more than perhaps even I think that I'm getting. Because when, you know, over a series of years, and both my books have taken 4 years of research and writing, the story is going to change. So what you think you're getting is different from what you end up with. And then what do you do then? What's the story? How are you going to find it? And all of those kind of issues in action, which keep you from getting bored, but it kind of always means that you can't really relax. You never really quite have that clarity, moral or process-wise, about your work until the end.
Mm. I imagine there's a lot of established and emerging and wannabe writers who are listening right now. And I'm keen if you would both share advice that you have about how to manage relationships with subjects that get a bit fraught. I mean, you could cite maybe an example if you wanted to. You don't necessarily have to name names, but I mean, how do you, because when you start, you know, talking to someone about, you know, wanting to write their story, and then, you know, you become more involved in their lives and you do further research and the story's developing, it's looking really good, but maybe the person wants to control the story, or maybe the person has an issue with the way you're telling their story. Maybe something has happened where they're not so sure anymore. How do you navigate that kind of time when things like that can happen? Jenny, can I ask you first?
Yeah, I had something go south for Everything Harder and Everyone Else, where I decided, I'd interviewed some bodybuilders, I'd shadowed them, and then, you know, they had really compelling stories. But afterwards, I was thinking, damn it, I've managed to choose two people who don't take performance enhancing drugs. And that's a bit of an oversight when you're writing about Everything Harder. So I was like, God, what should I do? I know, I'll take some. And I'll write about, you know, what that feels like and just write it into the chapter somehow. It wasn't the best thought out plan, I have to say. But, you know, sometimes it's just, let's throw a bunch of mud at the wall and see what sticks. Some stuff will make it in, some stuff won't. So I managed to get hold of some testosterone from a doctor. So it was legal on my part, although his part may be a bit more ethically dubious. but so it turned out, though, that it wasn't in any shape or form the level that would be used by bodybuilders, by female bodybuilders. It was actually like a gel that's sometimes prescribed, although not so much in this country, to just older women, who it's to help them sort of get the levels that they once would have had as a younger woman. So it's not like a sporting feats performance enhancing drug at all. But anyway, so I interviewed a strength coach who basically trains older people in putting on muscle, that kind of thing. And he started off okay, but then, and I don't know if this was the reason he took offence. I think he felt like I was dabbing a toe, but he also writes and about this area. And I think he just got increasingly irritated in our interview. And he wound up reporting me to ASADA, which is the anti-doping authority, with a bit of a mic drop, you know, like he sent me this sort of abusive email afterwards, saying, you know, that you think you can write about this topic and understand it is an insult to me and everyone in my industry, and I've reported you to ASADA. So that was all happening in the middle of like the longest lockdown in the world last year. And, you know, I was thinking, am I going to get this sort of, you know, government knock at the door? And, you know, I don't think I've actually literally done anything wrong, but now this has completely taken an unexpected twist. And so the way, of course, I thought I should handle this is to write it into the book. And I was talking to my friend, he's a journalist, and she was like, but this is gold. He's handed you absolute gold. And I wound up spending way longer than I should have writing probably about 4 pages worth of how this completely unraveled, because, you know, there's more to it than this story. It was quite a lengthy falling out with this person. And but yeah, in the end, you know, it was literally the week of going to the printer. I was talking to my publisher and he was like, you know, this was supposed to be a chapter about strong women, you know, women who are trying to take up more space in their bodybuilders, and it's to empower themselves, and you've just given 4 pages to this dude you've had an argument with. So we decided to take it out. But look, my short answer is sometimes something going wrong could actually send things off into a really interesting tangent.
Yeah. Interesting. Sarah, could you speak to that at all?
Yeah, no, I mean, like for those kind of, you know, emerging writers or aspiring writers, factual writing, you will find, and I'm sure this happens in fiction. In fact, my friends that do write fiction say you're not spared any of this just because you've fictionalized or completely created a world. But in my experience in factual writing, particularly, you will come up very quickly against this issue of wanting to be liked and wanting to be correct. And I think as women particularly, we struggle with that. And you're going to have to struggle with it in public if you're successful. And I remember very, very early on in my career reading, again, Janet Malcolm, her ghost hangs over this conversation benevolently, I hope, reading The Journalist and the Murderer and thinking, ugh, Janet, this could just be resolved if you were simply honest about the context in which you were working. And it's not true. You can be as frank to your subjects as it's possible to be. You can keep them constantly updated. And then in the writing up of, the story in which they may be the whole story, they might be a part of the story, your judgment or your discernment may be different from what they would like you to write. And you have an obligation to this person in the terms that you framed it at the beginning of your agreement to work together or to tell their story, but you have an equal and I think higher obligation to your reader who purchased a book of or borrowed a book of nonfiction, and that book has to do what it says on the cover. So if you're compromising what you know to be right or what you feel very strongly to be right in the name of being liked, you perhaps should go find something else to do. So, and it's just going to be uncomfortable and you have to sit in it. When I write certain things, it depends what it is, how journalistic it is, if it's a book versus a newspaper piece. If the person is, a very vulnerable person, I will let them read before I publish. Not necessarily amend things, but at least we can have a conversation about anything that they're not comfortable with. That's every time I've done that, I've ended up having to change nothing or having to change details that seem to me completely, irrelevant in terms of the nature of their pain, but were important to them. Like the color of a carpet was one of them, rather than, the fact that someone says that. So, but you've got to be frank about what you're doing. And, you don't make a promise to write a story in a particular way. And you keep them updated. You might have to give reminders about the nature of why you're in the room, depending on, what you did. But that's the job.
Can I just make a recommendation? Because we've brought up Janet Malcolm a few times. There is a relatively new podcast called Morally Reprehensible. And it's fascinating because it's about, in the first instance, journalist Joe McGinnis, who was accused by a murderer of stitching him up and not being honest. And then it's also about Janet Malcolm writing a book about that and also not being honest. And so there's these layers of subterfuge, and it's an ethical minefield you have to unpick, and it's just fascinating.
Wow, I could talk about Janet Malcolm all day. But we only have a few more minutes left of this podcast. And I do, it's really interesting what you've just said, because to me you are both incredibly passionate about the people and that you write about. You're very interested in what their stories are and what makes them tick and all that sort of stuff. It must be quite distressing at times when the people who you want to write about, have a different sort of take on or, dispute your motives and, the way a piece of writing comes out. Is it usually, am I wrong in saying that it's the people that inspire you to write rather than the actual subject matter? For example, Sarah, was it flying saucers, belief in flying saucers that made you want to write about flying saucers, or was it the believers in flying saucers that made you want to write about that?
Oh, well, for that chapter, it was the story of Frederick Valentich, the lost pilot.
Yeah.
And more than that, his fiance who was left behind. And so it is always the kind of the personal aspect of the story. I mean, I see the story as a personal story. So to me, they're not readily separable.
Mm. I mean, it's a story of grief, her story, really, isn't it? Grief that lasts to this day, really.
I mean, and each of those stories in my book was about somebody's personal experience of grief. So there are stories about grief, and the title of the book is also referable to me as a believer. So it's, I'm believing in the value of sitting and having these conversations with people about their lived experience and their stories. Even if I don't believe what they're saying, I believe in the value of the exchange. So, I mean, I get the question, but I also think, like, whether you're there for the people or the story they're telling you, they're, at the end of the day, they're the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Thoughts on that, Jenny?
Oh, I always start with a theme I'm interested in, and it's always completely selfish. Like, it's something I feel I need to know, like a burning need to know something. So, of course, with addiction, it was like, what the hell's wrong with me? And with the latest book, it was more about endurance and, like, how do some people endure more than others? And, you know, is there such thing as this all or nothing personality? But you know that if something fascinates you enough, then it will fascinate somebody else, so yes. or lots of other people. So, you know, it starts with the theme, and then I look for patterns and the people who fit these. And, you know, of course, you do have to cherry pick. It's all part of it. Otherwise, you would end up with something that's just, you know, finite. So infinite, sorry. yeah, I mean, then it's just a case of finding these larger-than-life outliers who are very self-aware. You know, I was lucky enough to get people like the wrestler Crackerjack, who he's like the star of his own reality show, really. You know, he's got plenty of homespun philosophy, larger than life quotes and cultural references, talking about living life at the end of a lightning bolt. And, you know, it's a perfect interviewee, really. As opposed to, there was a porn star interviewed called Orion Star, who was also a MMA fighter, so she was like giving and receiving punishment, but wasn't as fascinating as I'd hoped, because she just didn't have that insight. So, you know, I'm not choosing naive people who just do what they do and they're quite good at it, or doing something interesting. Like, they'll have given it a lot of thought, and that's really obvious when you initially have that conversation with them. And then, of course, you keep going back and having more conversations to make sure that you are getting this rapport and you are delving deeper. So it's not really surface level. You know, you make sure that they're people who are switched on and savvy, for me.
Right, right. So they're self-aware, yeah. It's not just all bravado.
No, but that helps.
It does. Look, we should wrap up there. Look, thank you so much for talking to me today. We have been talking to Sarah Krasnstein and to Jenny Valentish about these fantastic books that they've both authored this year, two of my favourite books, Completely Unputdownable, and just such shiny examples of how people make the most interesting stories. Congratulations on the books, guys, and thanks to MWF for having us.
Yes, thank
thanks
you.
So much, Elizabeth. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.